From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. I have a hunch the most difficult thing about today's show is going to be trying to get everyone to agree on the numbers. Today in the program, we're continuing our series on Utah's bad air. We've talked about transportation. We've talked about the role of government. Today, we're talking about industry. And there's a number, or there should be a number, that we can all come up with that tells us what percentage of the air pollution comes from industry in this state. But this is where it gets complicated, because it depends on what you mean by air pollution. It depends on what you include in that term and on the area you're measuring. We'll try and make sense of the numbers today as we ask where industry fits in the picture. We're asking what they're doing or not doing to deal with the air quality problem, and we're hoping to hear from you. What are you asking from industry, and how do you balance economic rights with public health? Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're offering another installment in our series on Utah's air quality problem. So far, we have talked about transportation, we've talked about the role of government, and today we're talking about industry. In the debate over air quality, there's a lot of focus on this part, the question of just how much industries like Kennecott Utah Copper and the Holly Oil Refinery, how much they contribute to the problem. Well, we're exploring the question today, the part of industry where it fits in the big picture. We're also asking what they're doing or not doing to limit their impact, and we want to know from you and others what it is you want from industry. So we're hoping you'll join the conversation today. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. We begin today with industry, with Kennecott Utah Copper, in fact, the biggest source of industrial pollution in the Salt Lake Valley. Earlier today in the program, we spoke with Kyle Bennett. He's a spokesperson for Kennecott, and also Steve Sands, who is Kennecott's director of external affairs. And we began with the most basic question. How much, as a percentage, does Kennecott contribute to Utah's air problem? Kyle Bennett had an answer.
Annually, we account for 5.8% of fine particulate emissions in the airshed, and on an average winter day, we account for 3.8% of fine particulate emissions in the airshed.
Some of the advocates of clean air say that that number is in some way misleading, that it kind of bundles all these different counties together. Then when you're just focusing on particular counties, like Salt Lake County, that number goes up significantly. I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that.
So Doug, this is Steve. I'll take that. The state of Utah made a recommendation around what the geographic area of the non-attainment boundary should be for the fine particulate PM2.5, and EPA subsequently made a determination that it was Salt Lake, Davis County, parts of Tooele County, and Box Elder. And so that's the geographic extent of emission sources that are influencing our wintertime particulate problem. And so to accurately calculate our contribution, you should take the sum of the emissions of PM2.5 and precursors in that geographic area and compute what our emissions are. And if you do the calculation correctly, as Kyle stated, we're 5.8% on an annual basis, and we're 3.8% of the wintertime, typical winter day inversion.
So you dispute this idea that if you tease out particular counties, I mean, that's the sense that I'm getting from advocates, is they're saying that that's what you're trying to do, is kind of obscure the actual numbers by focusing on a broader range as opposed to saying in Salt Lake County, this is what we contribute.
But the data that we are reporting is data that we report to the Division of Air Quality as part of our permits. It's part of the regulatory requirements in which we operate under. So based on that and their requirements for us and the parameters that they've set for us, that's how we come up with that data.
Well, let's get particular. What is your contribution for Salt Lake County then?
So the again, Doug, the particulate boundaries are actually set by EPA,
right.
The non-attainment boundary, and so emissions don't follow sort of geopolitical boundaries. You know, the area that's influencing the particulate problem during the winter months is actually well defined based on the geography of the state, the mountain ranges, and the areas that are influencing the monitors in the Salt Lake Airshed. And so we haven't explicitly run that calculation to determine what our contribution on a county basis is, because that's not relevant to the PM2.5 wintertime national ambient air quality standard that we're trying to solve.
I've heard, though, that there are figures of up that it represents something like 25%. Could you get in the of Utah, of Salt Lake County, that your contribution of emissions is 25% in Salt Lake County? Do you know enough to say that that's wrong?
It depends on which pollutant you'd be talking about and which area that you're talking about. Again, we haven't run those calculations specifically, but, on an individual pollutant basis or on an individual county basis, that there may be different percentages that someone could come up with. But the proper way to, if you're talking about trying to solve the wintertime PM2.5 problem, is to use the geographic area that's been defined by the regulators as influencing the monitors in Salt Lake Valley, mm-hmm. and then computing what our contribution of those primary particulate and precursor emissions are, to that area.
Right. In 2011, you were granted a permit to expand your operations for another 10 years, from 2018 to 2028. How much of an expansion are we talking about? What does that represent in terms of how things may change for Kennecott Utah Copper?
From the standpoint of what does it mean to our environmental footprint, certainly what I can say with a lot of confidence is that, we're buying larger, more efficient haul trucks. They reduce tailpipe emissions by 50%. We're going to be implementing better dust control measures and a lot of other, processes in order to actually be able to achieve more and reduce our impact. And so that's something that we're proud of.
Will expanding the operation or extending anyway the life of the mine, will that make you a worse polluter, or will you be putting out fewer emissions because of the standards that are going to come from the requirements that come from you expanding? Does that make sense?
Yeah, Doug. So if you look at the criteria pollutants or the pollutants that make up the fine particulate, there will be a net reduction from the projects that we've planned associated with the expansion. Anytime industry makes a change, they're required to reduce emissions in a non-attainment airshed like we have here in the Salt Lake area. And so our overall project emissions will, in fact, decrease on an actual basis in connection with the mine life extension project. And it's also, I guess, important to run the calculus right on even different contributions to the airshed, because we're focused on trying to solve the problem, trying to reduce emissions within our fence line, and also trying, where appropriate, to help other organizations reduce their emissions. And we want to make sure that we're working on the right problem here. So I think it is important to note that along with our expansion, we will be reducing our emissions. We've got other voluntary initiatives underway to improve our efficiency. We are working very actively day in and day out to try to reduce our environmental impact. But I think you do have to make sure that we've got the right numbers and that we're working on the right problem, because if we're focusing on a magic switch that we're going to be able to flip somewhere, at the end of the day, we're still going to have a problem on our hands. And so I know what I can say with confidence is, within Kennecott Utah Copper, we're working day in and day out to try to reduce our impact and to reduce our emissions. And we're trying to share that information external to our organization as well, to the extent that it can help others follow suit in reducing their impact. Because we do have an air quality problem, and there are some health and quality of life implications associated with that. So let's work together on solutions.
I wanted to give you a chance to respond to a contention made by the organization Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment. And they've suggested that this expansion is going to increase Salt Lake County's air pollution by almost 15%. I know you don't think about it in those terms. As you said, it's not a boundary issue for you, so maybe you can't speak to that. To the general contention that it will increase pollution, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, Doug. So one thing I can say is that each one of the approvals we received went through a rigorous and extensive environmental review. And what those reviews say, among other things, is that our permits cannot negatively impact attainment of air quality standards, and we must implement the highest level of pollution controls available. And I think we've achieved that. And through the processes, and as Steve mentioned, not only are we achieving those opportunities with the permits, but as Steve mentioned, you know, we're also taking a much broader look. It's not just about our operation. It's also about a lot of the things that we've done in the community to help create change. You know, we've brought light rail to the southwest part of the valley, which provides options for tens of thousands of people out here that didn't previously exist. We've worked with 100 companies to implement idling reduction programs. And what I think we'll see through those efforts, if those companies are anything like ours, we've seen our employees take those habits that they're learning at work and they're taking them home with them. And so what that does is it creates an opportunity for us as a business to continue down that path, and that's something that we're looking forward to.
I wanted to give you a chance to. It's been suggested by some critics that you are, in essence, because of this expansion, that you're kind of greenwashing your image. You know, you're reaching out to these community partners and things like that, and this, you know, marketing campaign to somehow absolve yourselves from some kind of responsibility, or in some way to distract people from the environmental impacts of your expansion and of your operation in general. Again, I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that.
Sure. Well, I think that's a very fair question. You know, our history shows that the air quality problem hasn't been a problem for us in the last 4 years. It's something that we've been addressing for a very long time. 2 decades ago, we invested $1 billion in a smelter that is still world class. It's the cleanest and most modern smelter in the world. Before we looked at the Cornerstone project, we were developing Daybreak, which is a community built on principles of sustainable development to have bike trails, that every home is Energy Star certified. You know, a lot of these plans, for example, Trax coming in, while Trax did arrive here in Daybreak just a couple of years ago, the vision for Trax was something that we had a long time ago. We've always provided scholarships to community to colleges and universities in the state. So what we're doing in the last couple of years is certainly not something that we're doing just because, as you kind of put it, a few people are calling us out. It's really been something that has been a part of our culture and our history for a very long time.
I wonder, this is kind of a crass question, so forgive me, but do you have a bottom line in terms of a economic number, how much you can afford, and at what point it becomes economically cost prohibitive to deal with these kinds of things? I mean, you've spent tens of millions, perhaps even hundreds of millions of dollars, as you've pointed out, in trying to deal with these questions of emissions. Where are you in terms of a kind of bottom line for all of this, if you think about it in those terms?
Well, let me address it like this. I think what you're talking about is really the business case for air quality, and absolutely, we believe there is a business case to help improve air quality. It's not just about the bottom line. You know, we also live and work in the Salt Lake Valley, and we understand that it's very important for us to align our business strategy and the needs of the community. I think there is absolutely a business case for it. I mean, I couldn't give you a bottom line dollar amount that we've established because, to my knowledge, I've never been a part of a discussion like that. But what I understand and know is that it's part of our social license to operate here in this community. And it's something that not only are we committed to it today, we were committed to it yesterday, and we'll be committed to it tomorrow.
I wonder where do you think, from your perspective, is this push for regulation kind of missing the mark? If you had a chance, for example, to kind of design an air pollution control program, how would it be different, if it would be different, from what the state is asking or what the EPA are asking?
Doug, my background's in engineering, and so the engineer in me says that if you could design a perfect plan, it would be focused on a technical component that's actually analyzing what's really happening out there. Where are the emissions coming from? What are the measures, the improvement things that can actually have an impact in improving air quality? And you'd be focusing dollars and effort and energy targeted at those initiatives that are actually going to result in measurable improvement to air quality, rather than focusing on a whole bunch of different activities in a very random way with the hopes that something's going to help solve the problem. Really be deliberate and tactical about going through very methodically and analyzing those different things that can be done to help make a difference, and then implementing those solutions. And I think the Division of Air Quality actually has a process for this under the State Implementation Plan, whereby they go through and analyze a lot of different options and control measures that could be implemented, and the ones that are actually going to help solve the problem are the ones that are mandated on regulated industries or advocated through messaging of the role that each individual plays in helping to be part of the solution.
So let me see if I heard you right there. Essentially what you're saying, and very diplomatically, by the way, is that the government could be more focused, could be more tactical, that in some ways they may be not entirely efficient in the way they're doing it now. Did I read that right?
I wouldn't say that at all, Doug. I would say that the regulators are actually looking at any and every opportunity to make improvement. The nature of the problem is that there's a whole bunch of small things that are going to help solve this problem. And certain point source industries like Kennecott are easy to regulate. You can impose mandates on them, and they do, to further make reductions where that's possible. But that's not going to be enough to help solve the problem. It's going to require some of these behavioral modifications of individuals and people. And those things are a little bit harder to regulate. And so kind of a complementary program to that would be do the technical analysis of the right things that everybody can do to help make a difference, and then do whatever you can to help encourage that kind of behavior.
Steve Sands and Kyle Bennett with Kennecott Utah Copper. We should mention this series is a collaboration with KUER's newsroom. And we should also point out Rio Tinto Kennecott Utah Copper is an underwriter of KUER, a sponsor of Radio West and the Utah Film Center's Through the Lens series. We should also point out those relationships are handled by KUER's development office, independent of the state's editorial decisions. You can join the conversation 801-585-WEST, our email address radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our series on Utah's air quality problem. We've talked about health. We've talked about transportation and the role of government. And today we're talking about the role of industry. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us now on the program, Judy Faze is back with us. She covers nuclear waste, climate change, and pollution for the Salt Lake Tribune. Judy, hi. Dan Baumas with us, of course, reporter for KUER. His story on our Clearing the Air series aired this morning. We have a link to it on our website. Welcome back to you, Dan.
Hi, Doug.
And I want to start, I guess, Judy, with what seems like kind of the predicament when you're covering or talking about this issue, and that is these numbers that seem to be kind of all over the place. And I wondered, I mean, you've run the numbers. This has got to be is this the hardest part of doing this story?
It's been a real challenge, but when you're trying to provide solid information for your readers, it's kind of important, I think, to double check. I went into my analysis, and I go into my analysis with some skepticism. I'm an ordinary person in that respect. And so going through the numbers, I think, is really helpful to ground me in a perspective of what's happening out there, what do the numbers say, what do we know?
And I guess it's difficult too. And Dan, I suppose you've encountered this, that you've got a lot of competing agendas, so you have to take all of that into account when you're covering a story like this.
And agreeing on what the source of the numbers might be is a difficult place to begin. I think one area where there's broad agreement that the numbers are at least useful is in this document called the 2008 Annual Emissions from Point Sources by County. This is something that's published by the Division of Air Quality, and it lists all the industrial point source polluters in the state, which means those who emit, I believe it's 10 tons or more of regulated pollutants in any given year. It's 11 pages long, okay?
Right.
And we're talking about Kennecott and the Holly Oil Refinery. But they are just two entries on this very long list of industrial point source polluters.
And you've pointed out just a moment ago, in fact, that Kennecott and the Holly Refinery, they've been willing to talk to reporters, which not all have.
Not all have, right. I mean, there are some businesses that don't feel it's in their interest to cooperate with the media at all on this.
Okay, so if you – let's start with this, I guess, Judy. If you look at all of the offenders in terms of the – you know, the air pollution issue in Utah, consumers, and you've got geography, you know, topography, you've got all, you know, all these different issues. Where does industry fit in the scheme of things?
In terms of percentage, it's probably the smallest piece of the pie. Transportation is the biggest. It's more than half. And area sources, which I think of as basic stuff we do every day, you know, heat our homes, use different kinds of products, go out and take out food that was grilled. I mean, there's a lot of different things that we do ordinarily that include emissions that are part of the problem.
Do you think there's a misunderstanding about that? There's a lot of attention paid to industries, a lot of focus paid on industries. And we're seeing a lot of this in our Facebook comments, and I'll get to some of these as they go, that something like you mentioned, a lot of this has to do with individual action, and maybe our focus is on – and it should be, but maybe the equation isn't quite worked out in everyone's minds when they're thinking about their responsibility.
Well, I think that I've really come to see dealing with air pollution as – partly an atmospheric science problem and partly a social science problem. And the social science problem part of it is I think people would be way more willing to, you could use the term, accept responsibility or do their part if they knew exactly what it was that they're supposed to do to make a difference. And I think for a lot of people I've heard, you know, they say don't drive less or they say to drive less, so and that will help. But I'm not really sure that's actually a practical solution for a lot of people. So does that mean you don't have your job? You can't get to your job when you need to? Okay, maybe it means taking public transportation. But when I think of my friends with small children, you know, trying to herd them at a bus stop when it's, you know, lower than freezing and, you know, miserable outside, I don't know if that's really fair to ask them to bear that kind of burden. To save all of us when everyone is not sharing that burden equally. So it seems to me that things like better planning, community planning, so transportation is more convenient and easier to access is a big help. And it seems as though a much stronger outreach and education program would be really valuable.
And we also miss, I think, the big blank area of this, which is area pollutants that we mentioned. I mean, in the Uinta Basin, the area pollution sources are oil and gas wells, and there are lots and lots of them, but none of them are big enough to be regulated as a point source polluter.
Yeah.
There are other area source polluters. I talked not long ago with John Chevalier, who runs a big auto body shop in Ogden on Riverdale Road. And he is having to rein in his emissions under the proposed state implementation plan. He's willing to do it, if not exactly cheerful about it. I think that represents some of the things that are more difficult to do. The big industrial polluters are targets. They have to get permits for any expansion that they do in a non-attainment area, and that has required them to spend an awful lot of money.
Yeah.
Okay, they still contribute a significant fraction of what's going on. But then once we get away from them, it becomes harder. It becomes harder to regulate area sources. It becomes harder to ask people not to drive. And that's where you start to wonder whether voluntary efforts, similar to the governor's UCARE program, are actually in a position to make a difference. You know, Kennecott and the oil refineries can point to, we spent this much money, we reduced pollution this much. Okay. The folks who live in my neighborhood in Bountiful can't quantify that as easily. But again, there's shared responsibility there.
I want to come back around to this point because I don't want to give people the sense that we're letting industry off the hook. So let's jump in there. What is essentially industry's part in the air pollution in this state? I mean, there is some dispute on the numbers here. I've seen as much as 36%. I've seen – the lowest number I've seen is from the governor's office, which says industry contributes something like 11%. Do you want to help make sense of those numbers? Where are we really?
That 11% number specifically, and I asked two gentlemen in the Utah Division of Air Quality about that. That is in the whole airshed, which is what our friends from Kennecott were talking about,
yep.
Industrial Point polluters, their contribution to that. So in a specific narrow area like Salt Lake County, that number might be higher. You go to Cache County, where there are far fewer industrial point sources of pollution, it's much lower. But if you look at the non-attainment areas that the state regulates, then industrial point source polluters are responsible for 11% of that wintertime air pollution. And that was the infographic they had on their website.
Right. Do others dispute it?
They certainly do.
No, that's actually correct. But I think it's really an interesting problem because, as you mentioned earlier, different people have different purposes with the data that they're looking at. And so if you're trying to create a forward-looking plan to reduce the pollutants that contribute to winter pollution, that's one goal. Another goal is to prove that large emitters don't deserve to put any more pollution or any other pollution into our airshed. Another purpose might be to curb all kinds of car growth or adopt maybe a California model for cars. So there's all these different goals that are behind the numbers. And I think that one of the controversies that's popped up is that people who are concerned that the refineries and Kennecott in particular are dumping into the airshed and making things worse, there are also people who have lawsuits that are challenging the rights of those facilities to expand. And I don't know that trying to have a conversation about that goal and trying to develop a forward-looking plan for a state implementation plan is really the same thing. And I don't know if it's helpful to talk about them together at the same time. I will admit, though, that, and I think it's important to point out, that if the refineries and Kennecott were to grow too much and add too much pollution to the airshed, the state would really be in a terrible bind in terms of finding a state implementation plan that will actually work. So
they've struggled with it already.
Absolutely. But in my analysis, some of the companies have already undergone three different SIPs, PM10, ozone, and I think CO.
And SIP is State Implementation
Plan. I'm sorry.
Plan. That's
Thank
okay.
you
yep.
for correcting.
Acronyms
yeah.
are all over.
Yeah,
they
sorry
are.
About that.
Gee, yeah. Keep going.
And then every time they get a permit under new federal law, they have to prove that they've got the best available technology for moving forward. So they've already ratcheted down under that. And then in the case of the refineries, they are under consent decrees by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency that are nationwide that require them to reduce their emissions. Again, not to say there aren't further cuts that can be done or will have to be done, but they already have done it, and they are the easiest target. They're the most visible, and they're the easiest to herd because they're the fewest of them.
And you help to pay for those regulations and the compliance when you buy that gallon of gasoline.
Right.
801-585 West, the number to join us. Brad has been waiting in Salt Lake. Brad, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah. So I work in the industry as an independent contractor, specifically working on boilers, which is one of the big industrial polluters. And for a long, long time, I thought this is a it's got a strange situation. We talk about permitting these boilers and permitting the air pollutants and regulating them, but they draw a permit on what they say they can do, but at no time ever in the life of an industrial boiler is that checked by anyone other than the owner of it. And so the state itself doesn't actually, the state or the EPA or any of these other companies don't actually say that it does what it says it can, such as, like, if you had a car and you said it only puts out this amount of emissions, but nobody ever checked that. We have our cars checked every other year when we get them, re-registered. And that's not done on these industrial things. And I've always thought that we have the technology to do it, but no one's ever checked if it's installed properly or if it's working or if it's doing what they have. And large industrial sites like Kennecott, they're so large that they self-check inside. So when they say they're putting out X amount of pollutants, they truly are with all those numbers. But most everyone else, they draw a permit, and that's the end of it.
Judy, you want to respond to that? What do you think about that idea? I mean, that they are checking the bigger ones, and now you've got these smaller ones that maybe they're not paying so much attention to.
I don't know enough about that area to know for sure what the schedule is for inspections and that kind of thing. I don't know if they're part of a broader inspection program that the state has. But he does sort of point out one really interesting issue about environmental regulation in general, and that is that industry polices itself. That's sort of a fundamental principle of how environmental regulation is done. And so it wouldn't be entirely out of the ordinary if we were relying on data that was provided by a company that had an interest in what the data looked like. But I do think that the state has ways to check that on paper and possibly in person.
And right. Could they shine an infrared laser through a plume coming out of a smokestack and tell us something about the emissions coming from that place? But Judy's right. The industry is asked to police itself, and the big ones like Kennecott employ people and pay a lot of attention to this, and many others don't.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Charisse Udell is joining us now, founder of the advocacy group Utah Moms for Clean Air, joining us from the radio station KWCR on the campus of Weber State University up in Ogden. Charisse Udell, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning.
Well, so what are you hearing so far? I wanted to get your sort of broader perspective on how you're thinking of the industry part in the air pollution problem.
Well, I think Brad, I think it was that just brought up the conversation about the boiler, reminds me and should remind everyone listening here that having industry self-report is like having the fox monitor the hen house. Generally not a good idea. And I think an EPA report came out a few years ago saying that they generally understand that the numbers reported by industry are vastly underreported. So I would say that, we really should be putting more money into the regulatory system so that we have more than what happens too frequently, which are called drive-by regulatory checks. You know, the person at EPA actually is just in their car driving by the refinery, and that's how they actually do their checks, unfortunately. That's not always the case, of course, but too often it is.
When you're allocating money, Charisse Udell, Let's take the governor's numbers. I'm not sure if you accept them, but let's take the governor's numbers that 11% of the pollution problem comes from industry. And you've got these regulatory agencies which means 89% is coming from the rest of us in essence. How much money would you allocate to pay for permitting and regulation compared to the other part, which seems to be the bigger part, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I don't think I'm equipped to answer that question as far as like where the money should go. But I will step back on your question about the 11%. I think that number is disingenuous at best. It has a very clear political agenda. All the advocacy groups that are working on this issue have been somewhat offended, actually, by that number, because I was just actually meeting with the governor yesterday and with Bryce Bird from DAQ and Amanda Smith. And so I asked Bryce specifically, I said, when you do those numbers, for example, does it include Rio Tinto's entire huge fleet of diesel-spewing trucks, right, that operate 24 hours a day, 52 weeks a year? And he said, no, that's not included in the industrial 11% because it's not a permitted source. Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, where does it land? And he said, well, the ones that stay on site are actually in the area source category, and those that actually go off site are then in the transportation category. And so I also asked, well, what about FedEx trucks and UPS trucks and the Postal Service and police cars and airplanes? Where do they fall into this? So as we started to discuss it more, we found out that it's not so clear-cut that industry is just 11% because part of their operations end up in the other categories. So I find that this number is incredibly disingenuous, and it's not really productive for the conversation on cleaning up the air in along the Wasatch Front.
Where would you put it if you could venture some kind of number?
Where would I put those numbers?
Yeah.
Well, again, you know, I'm a mom with a social science background, right? Okay, so to be fair, this is not my area of expertise,
okay,
but we do have scientific advisors who, one of them, for example, actually requested from DAQ all of the data sets and the assumptions based on that infograph. And the end result was is that those numbers are in some ways pie in the sky. They're pulled out of the air, literally and figuratively, and they're not, because a lot of them actually are unknowns, and they can't actually be nailed down that specifically, because there's just too many unknowns, for example, the way that PM2.5, what the precursors are to PM2.5. Again, I'm not a chemist, I'm not an engineer, I'm not a meteorologist, you know, but what I do have, like in front of me right now, is the 2008 DAQ emission inventory report for Kennecott's permitted sources, and if you actually look, they're responsible, according to their own reported numbers, which again are probably underreported, their PM2.5 for Salt Lake County is 66.2%. Their SO2 is 78.7%. And when that's for the Salt Lake County. Now, I understand that the EPA looks at the entire airshed, not just one area. But I think that, you know, obviously that's to their benefit because then they're able to water down those numbers. The Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment have done some number crunching, and they're pretty confident that Rio Tinto is responsible for about a third of the pollution in our airshed. I think that number sounds more accurate because when you also look at national inventories, Rio Tinto is one of the largest polluters in the United States. How can they be the largest polluter in the United States and only be, what did they say, what did Steve Sand say, 5.8% of fine particulate emissions?
Yeah.
So I just don't buy it.
Judy Faze, I wanted to get you on this question. You heard that reluctance on the part of the representatives from Kennecott to distinguish one county from another in, you know, the broader edge airshed about what, you know, what I guess the point they're making is they're trying to focus on, they're saying if you focus on the affected area, which is all of these counties, why does it matter, you know, if Salt Lake County is a bit more and Box Elder is a bit less or whatever? What do you make of that sort of distinction that they're trying to make? Because critics are saying that they're trying to spread these calculations out so they can kind of fudge the numbers.
Well, it's kind of funny because there was a whole lawsuit about whether, for instance, I think both Tooele County and Box Elder County sued so that they wouldn't be included in the non-attainment area. They're like, hey, this isn't our fault. But there are plants like Nucor Steel in Box Elder County that are not part of the mix unless you extend the boundary out to them. I think it's just such a complicated problem. And I thought Charisse's point about, you know, how we include the trucks and the truck traffic, I think that's a great area for discussion. And it's one thing that if you look at the refinery permitting process, for instance, the increase in trucks hauling raw material to the refineries isn't counted in the calculation for whether they should be allowed to expand. That's not part of the pollution calculation. And that seems like it puts the DAQ in a very tough position on the one hand, they have to rely on the law that's in place in order to determine the refinery expansion. On the other hand, they can't count that transportation pollution, nor can they count, for instance, the exhaust from the airplanes and jet fuel at the airport.
Although I do want to point out that Delta Airlines and SkyWest are both listed as industrial source polluters on the state's inventory.
So at any rate, by law they're not supposed to count that fuel in the inventory. But it's a complex problem, and as I said, I thought Charisse brought up a good point about how do you look at the transportation and include that in the bigger picture.
Well, is there any effort being done, you know, by government to sort of everyone get on the same page and have all the same parameters?
Well, Dr. Minch from Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment, who's been very outspoken on this issue, brought up a really critical point in a conversation I had with him recently, which is that the industrial polluters and the Division of Air Quality are in large measure working on a regulatory problem. They have the definition of where the airshed is, the non-attainment areas. They have the definition of the particulates and the other precursor chemicals that go into the air. And they are focused on regulatory compliance. Can we meet the standards being imposed by the federal government? He says public health is a completely different issue, that we look at our wintertime inversions, you know, and that's what gets everybody's attention when things get really bad. But the public health issue goes beyond that. And if the question is, how do you address the public health issue associated with air pollution, that's a different question from regulatory compliance.
Charisse Udall, what do you think about that?
I completely agree with that assessment. One of the issues that I have, one of the reasons that we pick on Rio Tinto so much, and in some ways I feel bad, and on the other hand I don't feel bad at all, is that they're a for-profit entity and they make billions of dollars off of doing what they do that they send back to England. And part of that money that they make is created by the fact that they don't clean up all their pollution. So they're externalizing many of those costs onto our community. And in the process, making higher profits. I find that to be an egregious moral issue. Now, the little person like me that's, you know, driving to the grocery store or, doing the errands that I need to do as a mom, I'm not making a profit off of that. Yes, I'm externalizing some of the costs of the choices I make, but I'm not profiting off of it. And that's one of the big fundamental problems that I think the doctors and the moms have with Tesoro, Holly Refinery, Rio Tinto, Stericycle, is that they're making huge profits and they're making greater profits by choosing to externalize their costs of doing their business onto our community. And all we ask from them is they just pay the true cost of doing their business. We don't ask for them to do anything more than that. We think that that's completely fair and it's the right thing to do.
But what are you talking about? What do you mean exactly? Let's take the Holly expansion that they're in the process of trying to expand their capacity, double their capacity, in fact, there. What would you expect, Charisse Udall, in terms of how much more money should they be putting out? And what do you mean by spending more money? What do you mean exactly? Do you know?
Well, you mean how much money?
Yeah, I mean, you're saying they should be spending more, they should be offering more because they externalize these costs. They talk about the fact that they've spent $50 million over the past 10 years since the Holly Refinery.
$100
million. Since they purchased that refinery. So how much more are you expecting?
Well, whatever it takes to not cheat the system, because basically air pollution is cheating. It's the classic economic textbook externality. So it's something that someone does that harms others or imposes a cost on others that the person creating it is not paying for. And in the case of air pollution, we know that that's causing actually extreme harm to people. It's even taking lives. Along the Wasatch Front, we're losing between 1,000 and 2,000 people prematurely every year because of our chronic air pollution. So this is a public health crisis. The refinery needs to do everything that they can. They need to be using the least polluting technology and implement what's available to mitigate that pollution as much as possible. Now, Utah Moms for Clean Air is actually putting out a proposal, which we just talked to the governor about yesterday, is that the long-term plan for these refineries needs to be to move them out of this valley. Mm-hmm. Because when they were first built here, it was reasonable to have them here. We had a low population, but we no longer have that scenario. And the threat, the public health threat created by these refineries, is to the point where it's intolerable. So ultimately, these refineries need to be moved, and I think it's totally appropriate to have it subsidized by taxpayers. Maybe we need to have a bond to help move these refineries somewhere else, but they do not belong in this valley. Now, Rio Tinto is another story because obviously you can't move a mine. So I'm talking specifically about refineries. Ultimately, they need to be moved out.
Dan Bomas, is that at all realistic? Is that all practical?
Well, some of these refineries, like the Holly Frontier Refinery was built in 1937, back when Woods Cross was farm fields.
Yeah.
And to move them to another place opens up another set of questions. Say they completed, there's a paved road that goes to the Grand County line now from Vernal. And suppose they put refineries in Green River. Okay. Then you have a different set of industrial issues. One is the regional haze requirements regarding the haze put out by power plants and other industries in the area of Utah's national parks. That is another standard that industry is expected to meet. You also, of course, have the ozone issues. The ozone standards regularly exceeded in the Uinta Basin because of emissions from oil and gas wells.
But did the officials from the Holly refinery, was that at all something that they would even, do you think, consider?
I don't think they'd be planning to spend the amount of money they are if they had any plan to move at all. No.
It raises the other question that I want. Charissa, I want to get you on this as well, but Judy, you too. And this question about expansion. The Kennecott expansion, they were granted the permit to expand back in 2011. They're going to extend their use of that land until 2028. And then the Holly refinery expansion. The question is whether or not, as I understand it, when you're doing these expansions, the environmental standards go up. So is it a better thing to expand or not? Judy Faze, what have you found?
Again, I just know there have been requirements for that. There was a big fight during the Bush administration about whether or not that should go forward under the Bush administration, which many people say was not friendly to the environment. It was very friendly to the petroleum industry. That's when the consent decrees came out requiring all the refineries to clamp down on their pollution.
I think, Doug, there's also the big question is what do you get for the money that you spend? Okay, we can ask the industries to spend money, and they've spent a lot of money. But is there an area where more could be done with less money, say, in these area sources? And our friends up at the Pepperidge Farm Bakery in Richmond in Cache County were facing some regulation because they put ethanol out into the air. The yeast makes ethanol and that goes out when they bake their crackers. So the Pepperidge Farm plant was able to take some voluntary steps to reduce their emissions, and by doing that, they avoided some more serious regulation as an industrial point source polluter than they would have as they now are with as an area source.
Yeah.
So, John Chevalier's body shop in Ogden. And these area sources for the investment may be able to achieve a larger reduction in emissions than perhaps the big industrial sources have, since they've already addressed a lot of these issues and spent a lot of money.
And one other thing I guess I'd like to just put in here into the discussion is I think this – I've been covering air pollution for a really long time, for over a decade, and I really am so excited about people being involved and engaged in this issue in the Capitol, in industry, in the public. I really love it. But I wonder if the way we're discussing things now will lead to any practical solutions, because it almost seems as though the divide between, you know, we'll get rid of all the refineries and we'll shut down Kennecott, or at least try to shut it down sooner than it would have been. I think that just gets people's backs up so badly that I don't really see a way forward to address some of the other things that are doable. And again, I don't know that all those discussions should be off the table for the future, but the divide is so enormous and the health consequences are so huge that I do think that there needs to be at least small steps going forward.
Well, can I add in here? We,
yep.
We met with the governor yesterday, Utah Moms for Clean Air, and Carl with Governor We Cannot Breathe. And we actually, you know, offered an olive branch to them with a report that we put together, which we will make available out to the media probably in the next week. And the first thing that we asked for in that is, Governor, please just use an executive order and create a clean air commission that can really look at doing a wide assessment, a comprehensive assessment by experts in academia, scientists, and really, okay, this is what we're dealing with. Here's our baseline. And then let's look at targets. Let's put out really clear targets about how we can improve the situation and then how we can meet those targets. And if the governor moves forward with that, we are happy to walk hand in hand with him and move forward. We are more than happy to. One of the reasons why there's so much noise from groups like Utah Moms for Clean Air and Governor We Cannot Breathe and the docs is because we feel like the state government has not been responding, that they have been trying to ignore the issue. And so you have to get loud and you have to get a little more aggressive to actually get the attention that this deserves.
Cherise Udell is the founder of the advocacy group Utah Moms for Clean Air, joined us today from the campus of Weber State University. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Judy Faze, a reporter for The Trib, covers this issue and a number of others. Thanks very much for being
back.
Thanks,
Doug.
Dan, thanks.
My pleasure.
Very much. And Baumus, of course. You can go online and get you can hear Dan's piece that aired this morning on Morning Edition. We'll continue our series later. We'll give you the details about that a little bit later. Radio West, a production of KEWR News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.